How would you like to lose weight quickly while eating foods you love, like steak, eggs, cheese, and real butter? Better yet, how would you like to take control of your cholesterol, triglycerides, blood pressure, and blood sugar while boosting your energy level and powers of concentration dramatically? This probably sounds too good to be true, but it's not. In fact, we guarantee that you're going to experience some tremendous and powerful changes in your body with the Protein Power System. And here's the key. Your body already has the systems in place to achieve these incredible benefits. The Protein Power System is the technology that'll make it happen. Protein Power was created by Drs. Michael and Mary Danese, two prominent weight loss physicians who have conducted years of research and worked with thousands of patients in their clinic. Using their Protein Power technology, the Drs. Eads have reversed serious health conditions, including obesity, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, and high blood sugar. Now, for the first time, their amazing easy system, once available only to their patients, is now available for your own private use. And now, let's begin your own personal consultation with Drs. Michael and Mary Dan Eads.
Hello, I'm Dr. Michael Eads.
And I'm Dr. Mary Dan Eads. Welcome to the Protein Power Program. We're delighted to be speaking with you right now, and we want you to sit back, relax, and think of yourself as being in our clinic having a one-on-one consultation with us.
Now, we know you're eager to start right into the plan, but there are a few ground rules that we have to establish right up front. First, if you're on any kind of medication for high blood pressure, high cholesterol or triglycerides, high blood sugar, or really any other health condition, we advise that you consult with your physician before starting on this plan. The Protein Power Plan is very, very potent and it works very quickly, so it's best for your own doctor to be aware that you're on this program.
And second, it's very important that you go through each of these audio cassettes in order. This will allow you to fully understand the Protein Power Plan, how it works, why it works, the results you can expect, and how to make this plan work for you for the rest of your life. Listening to all these cassettes will take you about 4 hours. After you've listened to one side of a cassette, each side lasts about 20 minutes, we advise that you take a short 5-minute break. Stand up, stretch, walk around a little bit. This will aid in the learning process, and it will allow you to better absorb the information.
And remember, one of the great things about this home study program is that you can listen to these cassettes more than once. It's an excellent idea to review these tapes every now and then to keep the information fresh in your mind. And by all means, if there's a section you don't quite understand, or if your mind happens to wander off briefly, simply rewind the tape and continue.
Finally, and this is the best part of all, we want you to mentally prepare yourself for the changes you're about to experience. If you bought this program because you have a significant amount of weight to lose, start thinking about where you'll shop for new clothes when your weight starts to drop. Think about all the things that you want to do when you start feeling that dynamic boost in your energy and you have a desire to become more active.
And think about your peace of mind, how good you're going to feel when your cholesterol, triglycerides, blood pressure, and blood sugar come down.
Imagine living without the intense deprivation and the suffering involved with following a strict, low-fat, high-carbohydrate diet. Imagine not having to live off awful-tasting, low-fat foods and little itty-bitty salads. Imagine being able to easily eat out in restaurants, whether it's a fast food place down the street or a 5-star restaurant on your vacation. We have so many patients who tell us, thank you, thank you, thank you, I can live life again. We're absolutely confident that you will become one of our shining Protein Power success stories.
But before we talk about the Protein Power Plan in detail, first you need to know why low-fat, high-carbohydrate diets don't work. They never have and they never will. Over the past 20 years, people in America have been the unwitting subjects in a giant experiment, the hypothesis of which is that cutting our fat is good for us. The government's told us to cut our fat intake, radio and TV tells us to cut our fat intake, we read it in every magazine, our friends even tell us to cut our fat intake, our physicians tell us to cut our fat intake. But guess what? We've all listened. We have cut our fat intake. In fact, in April 1995, in an article entitled Too Much of a Good Thing that appeared in the Journal of the American Dietetic Association demonstrates this very nicely. It shows that over the past 30 years, our consumption of fat has decreased substantially. Now, if this hypothesis were correct, that cutting our fat truly is good for us, over the same period of time, we should have seen the decline in obesity, type 2 diabetes, heart disease, cholesterol, high blood pressure, and all these other diseases that have been laid at the door of being fat or eating fat. So we're a nation of thin, healthy people, right?
Wrong. According to that same article, During that same period of time when fat consumption fell so dramatically, the number of overweight Americans skyrocketed. Obesity jumped by over 30% just in the past decade.
That's right. And at the same time, the incidence of type 2 diabetes tripled, reaching absolutely epidemic proportions.
And the rates of death from stroke continue to climb. And now heart disease is back on the rise as well. And all this has occurred at a time when we've cut and cut our fat intake. Now, if fat consumption were truly the cause of those things, they would have decreased, not increased. So what's going on?
Well, it's pretty clear that fat's not the problem. That seems pretty simple. So if it's not fat, what is it?
Well, clearly, we didn't just cut the fat out of our diet. We took out fat, but we replaced it with something else because the total number of calories we eat didn't fall. In fact, if anything, we increased the total number of calories a little bit.
Yes, and we'll see later why this change to a low-fat diet actually makes us eat more. So, what did we replace the fat with?
Carbohydrate, starch, and sugar. Americans have adopted the USDA's food pyramid, which is low in fat and high in carbohydrate. Note that I didn't just say low in fat. It is a low-fat diet, but it's a low-fat, high-carbohydrate diet.
That's right. The two are virtually synonymous. A low-fat diet is synonymous with a high-carbohydrate diet. And we've turned to these low-fat, no-fat foods of every description and replaced the fat-filled junk we used to eat with fat-free junk. And fat-free generally means high carbohydrate. Look at the food labels. Take reduced-fat peanut butter, for example.
You know, there are several brands. Several of them trumpet anywhere up to a 25% reduction in fat on their labels. But if you take the time to look, you'll find that while they do have less fat, they've got double the sugar and more calories per serving than the product they replaced.
That's true. And you know, one of the more common things that people tell us when they come to our clinic is, you know, they say, "Doctor, I've cut my fat and I've cut my fat and I've cut my fat and I still just can't seem to lose weight." Or, "I just can't seem to get my diabetes under control," or, "I just can't seem to get my cholesterol to go down. There's got to be something wrong with me. I've got to have some kind of a problem. Why is this not working?" But there really isn't a problem with them. They really haven't failed at their diet. Their diet has failed them. The low-fat, high-complex carbohydrate diet has proven to be a dismal failure, not only by not correcting the problems it was designed to improve, but in many, many cases, actually making them worse.
Well, at least according to a group of nutritional research scientists who met in Dallas in April of 1996, they met there for the International Symposium on Dietary Fats and Oils in Human Health and Disease. After years and years of study, this world-renowned group of experts concluded that the high-complex carbohydrate, low-fat diet has failed. They agreed that it makes diabetes more difficult to treat, that it increases the risk for heart disease because it elevates triglycerides in the blood, and it makes the cholesterol more likely to form blockages in the arteries. Why? What's wrong with the low-fat, high-complex carbohydrate diet?
The problem lies in what we call its biochemical structure, in the mixed signals it gives to the body's essential metabolic processes. Primarily, its effect on a pair of hormones called insulin and glucagon. Now, you're going to be hearing a lot more about these hormones on subsequent tapes, but right now, let's consider some basic nutritional facts. Food is made of three components called macronutrients. These are fat, protein, and carbohydrates. Now, these macronutrients, fat, protein, and carbohydrate, in various combinations, compose any food you can think of. Now, of course, food contains other substances besides macronutrients. It has vitamins and minerals and even water, but really the only components of food that give us calories and find their way into our fat cells are the macronutrients, fat, protein, and carbohydrates. Now, let's look at the macronutrient composition of a few foods.
What about bacon?
Fat and protein.
A potato?
Mainly carbohydrate with a little protein. But remember, carbohydrates are starches and sugars, and potatoes are mainly starch. Now, how about butter?
Almost all fat.
Olive oil?
All fat.
How about whole milk?
A combination of fat, protein, and a substantial portion of carbohydrate found in the milk sugar.
Okay, let's look at just a couple of more. How about a candy bar?
Mainly fat and carbohydrate.
And sugar?
Nothing but carbohydrate.
How about egg whites?
Well, egg whites are really almost pure protein.
So in general, we can almost say that meats are mainly fat and protein, while plant foods are mainly carbohydrate. And since all calories in food come from these three macronutrients, fat, protein, and carbohydrate, it's obvious that if you reduce the intake of one, what are you going to have to do? Obviously, you're going to increase one or both of the others to maintain the same number of calories.
If, for example, you wanted to reduce fat intake, then you'd have to increase your intake of carbohydrates or protein to make up the calorie difference.
But it's not quite so easy to just cut one macronutrient out of your diet. You don't go to the grocery store and buy 3 scoops of protein, 5 scoops of carbohydrate, and 2 scoops of fat.
No, you buy meat, eggs, vegetables, breads, fruits, dairy products.
Yeah, and you can trim the visible fats on meat, for example, to reduce the fat content, but otherwise it's pretty much difficult to extract just one macronutrient from a particular food item. So really, the only way to change the ratios of fat, protein, and carbohydrates is to change, and this is important, is to change the types of foods you eat.
If you want to decrease your fat intake, you might eat less meat, eggs, or dairy products and replace them with grains, fruits, vegetables, or fat-free snacks. And that sounds reasonable, doesn't it?
Well, not really, and here's why. Humans don't require equal amounts of the 3 macronutrients for optimal health. The average person requires at least 70 to 100 grams of protein a day.
And that's about 300 calories worth.
Right, and at least 6 to 10 grams of linoleic acid. That's the type of fat that's essential to health.
And that would be about 75 calories.
That's right. And what about carbohydrate? How much of that do we require?
Well, the actual amount required by humans for health, and now listen here, is zero.
Zero. That's correct. And we didn't make these figures up. That's the consensus of scientific wisdom. Now, does that mean we can live on 375 calories a day?
No, it doesn't. But it does mean that if you get the remainder of your energy from protein and fat without any other carbohydrates, you would do just fine.
That's right. In their traditional culture, Eskimos eat very little carbohydrate. In fact, none during the winter months, and they survive very nicely to ripe old ages.
With very little heart disease, diabetes, obesity, high blood pressure, cancer, or any of those other diseases that we associate with a more civilized lifestyle.
And Eskimos aren't creatures from an alien planet. They have the same biochemistry and physiology as you and I do.
That's right. And you could eat that same all-meat diet, all-fat diet, and tolerate it quite nicely.
That's correct. And bearing in mind that fat and protein are essential to health, and carbohydrate isn't, there are no carbohydrate deficiency diseases known. What happens when we cut back our fat as the nutritional establishment recommends?
Well, since most of the good sources of quality protein, meat, eggs, dairy products, even tofu, contain a fair amount of fat, we end up cutting back on protein as well, replacing both protein and fat with carbohydrate. People who strictly follow a low-fat diet can easily end up deficient in protein if they're not very, very careful.
But possibly the worst news of all is that eating more carbohydrates stimulates your body to actually store more fat. Now let me repeat that because it's so important. Eating more carbohydrates stimulates your body to store more fat. In attempting to reduce fat intake, you can actually wind up getting fatter, because some of these macronutrients stimulate profound metabolic hormonal changes. Surprisingly, fat doesn't really do much to make you fat.
Carbohydrate, however, is another story. Eating a handful of jelly beans or a fat-free cookie can set off a Mad Hatter's tea party of metabolic activity in your body, bringing about a rapid increase in insulin and a decrease in its opposing hormone, glucagon. Even complex carbohydrates, those much-touted starches, even complex carbohydrates stimulate the same kind of response.
That's right, and that's because all carbohydrates are basically sugar.
And it makes very little difference whether it started out as a bagel or a potato. Starches are nothing more than sugar molecules, mainly glucose, hooked together by chemical links. To absorb wheat starch or corn starch or rice or potato starch into your body, your digestive juices have to break those links that hold the starch together so that it can release the simple sugars that they're made of. And that means if you follow a 2,200 calorie a day diet, that's maybe 60% carbohydrate, like the food pyramid would recommend, your body will have to end up contending metabolically with 2 cups of sugar a day.
2 cups of sugar a day. Now, if someone recommended that you eat a diet that contains 2 cups of sugar a day, you'd think they were crazy. But that's essentially what happens with the 6 to 11 servings a day of bread, cereals, and pasta that's on the food pyramid. It's so important to understand that these starchy foods must convert to simple sugars to enter your bloodstream. And when they do, they cause an elevation of insulin. And you might be saying, so what? I've heard of insulin, and it has something to do with diabetes. And if I don't have diabetes, what difference does it make if my insulin goes up?
Well, it makes a big difference, and here's why. Insulin, a hormone that's produced and released into your blood by your pancreas, affects virtually every cell in your body. It regulates blood sugar, yes, but it does so much more. It controls storage of fat. It directs the flow of nutrients into your tissues. It regulates the body's production of cholesterol. It's involved in appetite control. It drives the kidneys to retain fluid, and in a very real sense, it's a master hormone of your metabolism.
Right. But if uncontrolled, insulin can also become a monster hormone. There's really a dark side to it. In the proper amount, it's life-sustaining. It makes everything work just right. Too much of it causes enormous health problems. It's kind of like Goldilocks and the Three Bears. You know, too much is bad, too little is bad. You've got to have just the right amount. And there's a multitude of scientific studies with more added every day that implicate excess insulin, you know, too much insulin, as the primary cause, or at least a significant risk factor for high blood pressure, heart disease, obesity, elevated cholesterol, and other blood fats, and type 2 diabetes.
You know, an easy way to envision how all these different diseases are connected is to imagine a giant iceberg floating along in an Arctic sea. The many tips of the iceberg, the things that stick up visibly above the water, we could call obesity, diabetes, high cholesterol, heart disease, high blood pressure, and the big, huge mass of ice down below the surface we'd call hyperinsulinemia or insulin resistance.
Yeah, and you know, for many years, doctors, really ourselves included, have focused only on the visible tips. If a patient develops high blood pressure, we give them a pill for it. Their cholesterol goes up, we give them a pill to reduce it.
If you got diabetes, we give you another pill or a shot of insulin.
Heart disease, we do a bypass.
Obesity, a low-fat diet, or a pill, or even surgery.
We've spent years and years and years chipping away at the tips of the iceberg while ignoring the big, dangerous mass that lurks underneath the water's surface, the one from which all these visible tips spring. Now our strategy is to lay a dynamite charge in that submerged mass and get rid of it. And when we do that, we solve the underlying insulin problem. And when we solve this underlying insulin problem, we get rid of all these disorders that it's caused. And that's what's so exciting about the Protein Power Plan.
You know, insulin problems have a strong genetic basis too. So a good way to determine if you're at risk for an insulin-related problem, in other words, whether you have a reason to be concerned about elevating your insulin, is to examine your family tree very closely.
And you ought to consider yourself at risk if you or your grandparents or your parents had any of the following disorders. If they had a heart attack, a heart bypass, angina or heart-related chest pain,
high blood pressure, if they gained weight around the middle, if they had high cholesterol or triglycerides,
type 2 diabetes, excess fluid retention, the more of these disorders that you identify in your family, the more you are at risk. And if you are at risk, then you have a pressing reason to care about insulin because controlling it can literally save your life.
Well, how do you control it?
Easy, by adopting the principles in the Protein Power System. It's really a sensible, easy-to-follow program of adequate protein, moderate fat, and restricted carbohydrates that will modulate your body's metabolic hormones, including insulin.
You know, it's diet that makes insulin levels go haywire in the first place. So it stands to reason that dietary change should be able to reverse that problem. And in fact, diet is the only effective solution to this problem.
That is correct. There are no drugs or medicines that you can take to deal with an insulin problem right now. It's only diet.
Our plan uses food as a tool to reverse or at least markedly improve all of these disorders caused by insulin elevation.
And it's real easy to follow. It's tasty, it's filling, it's nutritionally complete, and best of all, it works, and it works very quickly.
In terms of feeling better and more energetic, really, you'll see results within a week or even less. For cholesterol reduction, for substantial lowering of blood values, usually just 3 weeks.
High blood pressure? We usually find that people get off their high blood pressure medication in just a couple of weeks.
For obesity? Wow. Our nutritional program opens all the metabolic pathways to allow your body to burn fat efficiently for energy. But that fat still has to be burned, and depending on how much there is to burn, that could take some time.
But it causes people to burn that fat and lose weight every bit as quickly as a low-fat diet, but in a more helpful way because people only lose fat. They don't lose lean body tissue, which is a big improvement over the low-fat diet. Now, granted, on these typical low-calorie, low-fat, high-complex carbohydrate weight reduction diets that people have been on forever, these medical disorders we've been talking about will sometimes gradually improve as body weight falls. But on our plan, the improvement is almost immediate because of the rapid metabolic changes that the program brings about.
You know, we don't purport to have all the answers, but we do have a nutritional program that we've tested on ourselves, our three sons, thousands and thousands of patients in our clinic, and countless people all over the country. Our approach is clinically proven. It's scientifically and historically valid.
Yeah, let's take just a minute to see what historically valid really means. Let's look at that for a minute. There are three ways that scientists gather medical data. The most common way is to perform studies in a laboratory or a hospital on animals or human volunteers. Now, these are the kinds of medical studies you read about in the magazines or the newspapers describing new therapies or risk factors for certain diseases. In the course of these tapes, we're going to be describing many studies of this type and how they apply to our nutritional program. Now, the other way to gather data is to perform what are called epidemiological studies. These are statistical analyses of large groups of people, often entire countries, that are used to determine how some sub-factor, lifestyle or diet perhaps, relates or influences the development of a disease. Now, epidemiological studies are the kinds you read about, for instance, that show that despite the fact that the French eat higher amounts of fat than Americans, that they have much less heart disease than Americans, the so-called French paradox. And again, during the course of these tapes, we're going to discuss a number of these epidemiological studies as they apply to our protein power plan. But a third and often overlooked but nevertheless extremely important type of study involves analyzing the diets and diseases of ancient people. Now, most of these studies appear in the anthropological literature, not the medical literature, so they escape the notice of most medical researchers. Anthropologists presented with the bones of an ancient human can tell in just a glance whether that person was a hunter or a gatherer or a farmer. I mean, it takes them 2 seconds just by the conditions of the bones. Now, because hunters and gatherers who live mainly on meat and nuts and seeds and occasional berries and fruits have stronger, better developed bones and teeth without decay and fewer indications of severe nutritional deficiencies or infections.
Well, what about the bones of the people who weren't hunters or gatherers? The bones of their farming cousins who live mainly on grain-based diets showed just the opposite. They were short. They had weaker bones. They had terrible tooth decay and many signs of nutritional deficiency and infections. There is no doubt from the historical record that hunter-gatherers who lived on ancient versions of our protein power diet fared much better than their counterparts who followed a high-complex carbohydrate, grain-based diet, much like the food pyramid.
Yeah, another interesting group was the ancient Egyptians, because they left millions and millions of mummies that allow scientists today to study not just the bones as they do in the other historical data that we were talking about, but actual arteries and organs and other fleshy tissues. The scientists studying this vast amount of Egyptian mummy data have determined that the ancient Egyptians suffered from heart disease, high blood pressure, severe tooth decay, gum disease, and many, many signs of other nutritional deficiencies.
And to top it off, they were often obese. And what makes this information really interesting is that these same Egyptians ate almost the exact diet, mainly whole grains with very little meat, that the nutritional establishment in this country would have us follow today to avoid all these same problems. And guess what? It worked just about as well for the Egyptians as it's working for Americans today. No wonder they call it the food pyramid.
And that's what we mean when we say that the protein power plan is historically correct. It's simply nothing more than applied biochemistry. It's a modern perspective on the diet that nature designed us to eat. That's why it works.
But how does eating a high carbohydrate diet cause all these problems?
Because it makes us make excess insulin.
Okay, now let's talk about the development of hyperinsulinemia and insulin resistance. Let's spend the next few minutes talking about insulin, how it works, what it does, and what happens when it gets out of control. But to better understand excess insulin, let's go over insulin's important minute-by-minute job in your body, and that is to control blood sugar.
That's right. When we eat carbohydrates, our digestive system breaks them down into simple sugars. Now, it doesn't matter if the carbohydrate started out as a jelly bean or a marshmallow or a baked potato. The digestive tract is going to treat it just the same. It's going to break it down into simple sugars so that it can be absorbed into the blood, because that's the only way it can be absorbed into the blood. Complex carbohydrates don't absorb into the blood, only simple sugars. So the job of the digestive tract, as far as carbohydrates are concerned, is to break them all down into simple sugars so they can be absorbed.
Now, the level of sugar in your blood is an incredibly important measurement as far as your body's concerned. The body strives to keep blood sugar in a very narrow range. It doesn't like for it to go too high. It doesn't like for it to go too low. Now, blood sugar does go out of this range multiple times during the day, but the body doesn't like it. And when it does go out of the range, the body marshals all sorts of physiologic forces to get it back into the range. The main force the body uses to correct sugar when it goes too high is insulin. It uses insulin to corral the blood sugar back down, kind of into this temperate zone.
Insulin is made in the pancreas, which is a big tongue-shaped organ that's in the back of your abdominal cavity that makes lots of digestive enzymes and other hormones. So when we eat carbohydrates, our digestive tract breaks them down into sugars, they absorb into the blood, and the blood sugar rises. And when it rises and goes out of this comfort zone, and when it does, it sends a signal to the pancreas to make and release insulin.
And then the insulin travels through the blood like a good hormone. You know, being a hormone just means that it's a substance produced in a gland that's released into the blood and that travels through the blood and causes something to happen. It's like a chemical messenger. And so, like a good hormone, insulin gets into the blood and travels through it and washes over the cells of the body. And a lot of those cells have sensors on their surfaces that insulin can attach to. They're called insulin receptors.
And they can just as easily be called sugar pumps, because that's basically what they do. When insulin attaches to them and turns them on, they pump sugar out of the blood and into the cells, which is just kind of by medical convention. They're called insulin receptors because they're named after what makes them work, not what they do.
So to recap, insulin arrives at the cell, it binds to the receptor, and in essence, it flips an on switch to pump the sugar out of the blood and into the cells, right?
Right. And it doesn't matter how much sugar's inside the cell's really designed to deal with the sugar. The problem comes from the sugar in the blood. And so that's what insulin does. It moves sugar out of the blood and into the cells by activating the insulin receptors on the surface of the cell that are really basically these little sugar pumps. And if the system is working properly, and you could sit there and eat sugar out of the sugar bowl, it would go through the digestive tract, be absorbed into the blood. And if the system is working properly, you could sit there and eat sugar out of the sugar bowl. It would go through the digestive tract, it would be absorbed into the blood, and be immediately moved via these little insulin receptors from the blood into the cells. And your blood sugar would go up a little bit, if at all, but then it would drop right back down.
But if, on the other hand, there's a glitch somewhere in that system, then you've got a problem.
That's right. And the location of this little glitch defines the problem. For instance, kids, you know, kids are young adults who develop this more serious type of diabetes called juvenile diabetes or type 1 diabetes. They develop this disorder because something, usually a virus, destroys the cells in their pancreases that make the insulin. So they often can't make their own insulin. They have no ability to make their own insulin. And when these people eat carbohydrates, their digestive tract breaks them down into these simple sugars, and it gets absorbed into the blood. Their blood sugar rises, sends a signal to the pancreas, and then nothing happens because their pancreases can no longer make or release this insulin.
So what you're saying is that without insulin to activate the insulin receptors, they have no way to pump sugar out of the blood and into their cells. So their blood sugar goes higher and higher.
And higher and higher and higher. And if they don't get treated, they can die. And their only hope is an injection of insulin. And when they give themselves this injection of insulin, it travels through the blood and attaches to and activates these receptors. And these receptors respond by pumping the sugar out of the blood and into the cells. So when you take a young diabetic child whose blood sugar is, I don't know, say 350, and he gives himself an insulin shot, which drops it down to 90, which is right within the normal range, that's what happens. The insulin has activated his receptors and pumped the sugar into the cells where it can be used or stored.
But some people have the opposite problem. They have too much insulin. They have a disruption in the insulin system in a different location. They can make plenty of insulin, but the problem is in the receptors. The receptors are defective.
Exactly. The receptors are defective, and people have an inherent tendency to develop this problem. And that usually includes about 75% of people in this country to one degree or another. And they're going to gradually become resistant to the effects of their own insulin. And what this means is that their insulin receptors, and no one really knows how at this point, but their insulin receptors become resistant to the effects of their own insulin.
In other words, what you're saying is that it would take more insulin to make those sluggish receptors work.
Yeah, that's exactly what's going on. They'll still work, it just takes more insulin to make them work than it did before they became resistant. You can think of it kind of like a rusty door. You can still open and close a rusty door, it just takes a lot more force to do it than it does a door with perfectly oiled hinges. And that's how it works in a person with insulin resistance. You can think of their receptors as being kind of rusty, like this rusty door. That person's digestive tract works just the same. It still breaks the complex carbohydrates down into the simple sugars that absorb into the blood. The blood sugar level still rises and still sends a signal to the pancreas to release insulin. The pancreas responds normally. It gets the signal. It releases the insulin. And then nothing happens because the insulin receptors don't respond because they're resistant.
So then the pancreas responds by releasing more insulin until finally it releases enough insulin to overcome this resistance in the receptors and forces them to work to pump the sugar out of the blood and into the cells. Or in the rusty door analogy, it's like you push harder and harder and harder with more force against the door until it finally opens.
That's right, and the pancreas releases more and more insulin until it finally overcomes or overwhelms the resistance to these receptors and forces them to work. And people who develop this insulin resistance are going to ultimately reach some kind of a stable state where their blood sugar stays normal most of the time, but it's going to take a lot of excess insulin to keep it that way.
And that's the state we call hyperinsulinemia, and that's just a Latin term meaning too much insulin in the blood.
Now that's right. Now if regulating blood sugar were insulin's only job, this excess insulin really wouldn't be much of a problem. It would be just another one of the body's many, many ways in which one system kind of steps in to compensate when another system slacks off. We all have many, many redundancies built into us. But in this case, the pancreas is picking up the slack for the sluggish insulin receptors by making more insulin. Unfortunately, though, controlling blood sugar isn't insulin's only job. Insulin is really the master hormone for all metabolism, and it influences virtually every cell in the body. And when there's too much of it because we're compensating for these sluggish receptors, this excess circulating insulin goes through the body and wreaks all kinds of havoc.
Well, what kind of havoc?
Well, it causes a cluster of disease problems that have been called by various researchers Syndrome X, or the Metabolic Syndrome, or the Western Civilization Syndrome, or the one that I kind of like the best, the Hyperinsulinemia Syndrome. The diseases that make up this cluster include high blood pressure, elevated cholesterol, heart disease, adult onset or type 2 diabetes, elevated uric acid or sometimes gout, sleep apnea, gastroesophageal reflux, obesity, an iron storage disorder, and a number of others. Really, in short, all the diseases we've come to associate with a more civilized lifestyle, or diseases we seem to all develop in one way or another in middle age. So let's look at some of these disorders and see what excess insulin really does.
Okay, there's no question that excess insulin is the driving force behind much of the high blood pressure and stroke we see in America today. The jury's still out on exactly how insulin causes blood pressure to go up, but researchers in this area suggested maybe it thickens the artery walls, maybe it increases their tendency to constrict. But although those two effects remain speculative, there is no doubt that insulin does cause fluid retention.
And that's because insulin causes the kidneys to hold on to sodium. And anything that causes the kidneys to hold on to sodium or retain sodium is going to cause these people to retain excess fluid. And insulin definitely does that. It leads to swollen ankles and feet at the end of the day and puffy eyes upon arising in the morning.
And insulin also depletes the body of magnesium, which is a mineral that's critical to maintaining both normal fluid balance and normal blood pressure.
That's right. A lot of recent studies have shown that elevated insulin levels can cause a release of up to 30% of magnesium.
We're going to talk a lot more about magnesium a little later on with vitamins and minerals, but for now, let's get back to some of the other things that insulin does. There's a lot of evidence to show that insulin disrupts cholesterol production in a variety of ways. And, you know, we've begun to think about cholesterol as just something bad, something that people want to get down. But the scientific reality of the situation is that cholesterol is critically important to human health. So important, in fact, that if we don't get enough in our diet, our body will make it. Virtually every cell in the body can make it, but the liver makes the lion's share of it, right?
Right. Of what you find in the blood at any given time, only about 20% comes from diet. Your body makes the other 80%. So knowing this, it's easy to see that when you attempt to cut cholesterol by cutting it out of your diet, you can only affect that dietary 20%. A much, much more effective means would be to cut back on the body's own production, because that gives you the 80% figure to work on. And it's by this means that all these new expensive kind of statin-type cholesterol-lowering drugs work. They cut down on the liver's production of cholesterol.
But we can do the same thing just by lowering the insulin levels with our diet.
That's correct, because insulin works at the same point in the cholesterol synthesis pathway that these statin drugs work. But they have opposing forces. The insulin works to make more cholesterol, while the statin-type drugs work to inhibit it and make less. So by cutting down or lowering our insulin levels, we can decrease the levels of cholesterol the same way we can by taking the statin drugs without all the dangerous side effects associated with it.
And without all the expense as well.
Exactly, without all the expense, because these drugs are not inexpensive. So, since insulin drives the production of cholesterol, if we drop insulin levels, we're going to slow down or reduce production, and that's exactly what happens on the Protein Power Plan.
And although excess insulin causes disturbances in a number of places with cholesterol, the classic cholesterol profile of a person who has hyperinsulinemia is that they have elevated triglycerides and they also have a low level of HDL, what we think of as the good cholesterol. So they have elevated triglycerides and low HDL.
Yes, that's right. And in our practice, we often see the low HDL alone as the only marker of the problem. But more often than not, we see this combination of low HDL along with the high triglycerides and often elevated LDL levels, and that's often termed the bad cholesterol. All these abnormalities respond very well to the protein power plan.
But what about heart disease? That's another component of the hyperinsulinemia syndrome, and it's something that's on the minds of a lot of people out there.
That's true. And insulin adversely affects the arteries that carry the blood to the heart in a number of ways that actually forces the blood or can cause the blood to clot. I mean, there are probably a dozen ways in which insulin adversely affects the linings of the arteries that carry the blood to the heart. It makes them thicker, makes them more prone to develop plaque, it makes it more prone to trap the bad cholesterol particles, it makes the cholesterol particles more prone to become oxidized, and as a result of all this, now at least six major international studies have shown that elevated insulin levels, in the absence of any other risk factor, leads to a much greater level of heart disease than those whose insulin is normal. Now the results of these studies have led medical researchers to consider hyperinsulinemia or elevated insulin levels as a major risk factor for the development of heart disease.
Right up there with cigarette smoking, high blood pressure, or diabetes.
That's right, and you should note that every one of those other major risk factors also happens to be caused by excess insulin or insulin resistance, even cigarette smoking, because recent research has shown that smoking cigarettes leads to the development of hyperinsulinemia, causing many researchers to believe that it's the hyperinsulinemia that really puts smokers at risk for heart disease.
Strangely enough, excess insulin levels can actually cause adult-onset diabetes in those people who have a family history for it. You know, adult-onset diabetes, the one we sometimes call type 2 diabetes, is a very different animal from the juvenile form. People who have the adult variety of diabetes develop high blood sugar in the face of highly elevated insulin levels. And that seems strange since insulin's main job, we said, was to bring blood sugar down. So how could you have a situation where you have too much insulin and too much blood sugar?
Well, admittedly, it sounds strange, but what actually happens with people who have this disorder is that their insulin receptors have become so resistant to insulin that despite the fact that their pancreas is still churning out all the insulin it can possibly make, that's not enough to overcome the resistance in these receptors, in these highly resistant receptors. And once that happens and the receptors fail to work and they don't pump the sugar out of the blood, the sugar accumulates to highly dangerous levels, and that gives us this kind of paradoxical finding of excess blood sugar in the face of excess insulin. Now remember, these juvenile diabetics that we talked about before, they had elevated blood sugar and no insulin, but adult onset diabetics, every single one of them have elevated blood sugar along with the elevated insulin levels.
And what you're saying is that the reason this is happening is because the receptors are failing to work.
Correct. They fail to work. They've become so resistant that even though the pancreas is making insulin just as fast as it can, it's still not enough to overcome the resistance in these receptors.
So it's like having a rusty door that really is stuck.
Right, yeah, the rusty door won't work at all. It doesn't matter how hard you push on it, it's not going to open. And it's the same case here. And their blood sugar goes up and up and up, and they get into trouble.
Well, that's not all insulin does. Hyperuricemia, and that's a big word that just means elevated uric acid in the blood, that's the cause of gout, is another component of this hyperinsulinemia syndrome.
Gout, for those of you who have never suffered with it, and be glad that you've never suffered with it, is a condition in which a joint, usually the one at the base of the big toe, becomes inflamed, swollen, and excruciatingly painful. And this agony occurs when an elevated level of uric acid in the blood precipitates out and forms actual crystals in the joint fluid, which causes lots of irritation and all this ensuing inflammation and pain. This pain is sometimes so severe that even the weight of a sheet on the joint that's affected is almost too much to bear.
You know, if gout doesn't run in your family, that is, if you haven't inherited the genes for developing gout, you probably wouldn't develop it no matter how high your insulin got. But if you have inherited that tendency, even a mild elevation of insulin can bring it on.
And this brings up a really important point about this hyperinsulinemia syndrome that bears discussion. People often ask us, if insulin really causes all these things to happen, then why doesn't everyone with elevated insulin level have all these problems? Why do some people have elevated blood pressure and other people have bad cholesterol problems, or they become obese, and others, they develop heart disease, or they get gout, or some people have all these things? Why is that? Why is it that if insulin really causes all these things to develop, why doesn't it cause them all? How can it cause just one or two of these things to develop? Well, it's just like gout. You've got to have the right, or should I say, the wrong genetics. You've got to have the genetics in elevated insulin to cause this damage. For example, if you've inherited a family history for high blood pressure and your insulin goes up, you can be almost assured that your blood pressure is not going to be far behind. If, though, you don't have this genetic predisposition for high blood pressure, it almost doesn't matter how high your insulin goes. Your blood pressure is probably going to stay normal. And that's why everyone doesn't respond to elevated insulin levels the same way. As I said before, most people just get one or two of these components of the hyperinsulinemia syndrome. Maybe they're just overweight and they have elevated cholesterol, or they have high triglycerides and nothing else. While there are others who develop this full-blown syndrome, they're overweight, they have high cholesterol, high triglycerides, diabetes, heart disease, and high blood pressure, and have gout to boot. Now, the last major component of this hyperinsulinemia syndrome is the one that probably affects more people than any other, and that's obesity, the accumulation of excess body fat.
You know, we mentioned earlier that about 75% of adult Americans have a syndrome of hyperinsulinemia to one degree or another. And you know, the latest statistics show that 74% of adult Americans are overweight to some degree. You think that's a coincidence?
I hardly think so, because as I've said, most people with an insulin problem are overweight to some degree.
Well, how does excess insulin cause obesity?
It causes it by causing the fat cells to store more fat. You know, our fat cells are just little balloon-like structures whose only real job is to store calories away in the form of fat. And these little cells can get smaller or larger. They can expand or contract depending on how much fat comes in or goes out of them. And if everything works as it should, the amount going into the fat cells is the amount coming out, and their size really doesn't change over time. But if more goes in than goes out, the cells will increase in size, and they're going to develop a weight problem. So let's look at what makes fat go into the fat cells and what makes fat come out.
Okay, we eat a meal. Our insulin level rises because insulin's a storage hormone. It drives the sugar into the cells. It drives the fat from the meal into the cells to be stored. But not only does it drive the fat into the cells, it prevents the stored fat from escaping. You know, normally after we eat, between meals, at bedtime, insulin levels should fall. And at this point, another hormone called glucagon, it's also made in the pancreas, the glucagon rises and it acts in an opposing fashion to the insulin. We call it a counter-regulatory hormone because it acts virtually in every way in the opposite effect of insulin. Insulin and glucagon are kind of like an accelerator and a brake pedal on a car. And it's the coordination of those two things that makes metabolism move forward. When glucagon comes out, when it rises in the blood, it goes and retrieves fat out of the fat cells so that we can use it for energy. And at the same time, it blocks entry of fat into the fat cells. You know, I had a patient the other day who asked where they could get some glucagon. You know, it sounded so good. But anyway, this process continues until we eat again, and the insulin rises, causes a storage of fat, glucagon falls, and the cycle repeats itself. It's what happens normally.
That's what happens normally. But what happens when you develop a problem? Once you've developed a problem with excess insulin, it doesn't work quite so smoothly. People with hyperinsulinemia, excess insulin in the blood, always have elevated insulin levels, and therefore they're almost always storing fat. Even when they're not eating and have no new fat to store, the elevated insulin keeps what's already stored in the fat cells from getting out. So in the face of the elevated insulin levels, glucagon rarely sees the light of day and doesn't really get a chance to do its counter-regulating job. And as a result, people with hyperinsulinemia tend to continuously accumulate fat, kind of continuously and relentlessly accumulate fat, and find themselves getting more and more overweight as the years go by. And, as we'll explain in the next tape, the Protein Power Plan uses food to correct this problem, to reduce insulin levels while still stimulating glucagon to remove the fat from the fat cells. And remember, food is the only thing that will do it. There are no drugs to do this, but the Protein Power Plan will.